This is an FCIC interview of Pierre Mikotis, MICOTTIS, June 14th at 11:30 a.m.
Hi, Dorothy.
Got Pierre on the line, and Andy's here with me and Tom in New York.
Wonderful. So, hi, Mr. Mikotis. Thank you for joining us today.
How are you?
Good, thanks. I'm Dixie Noonan, and I have with me Donna Norman, Brian Sylvester, and Sarah Knaus. And we're going to tape record this call today. And Dorothy knew that. I'm sure she discussed that with you, so I just wanted to let you know that we're taping now.
Hey, Dixie, what were those names again? I didn't catch them all.
Donna.
Rose.
Donna Norman.
Norman, okay.
Brian Sylvester.
Right.
And Sarah Knaus, K-N-A-U-S.
A-N-A-U-S. Are all three of them lawyers?
Donna and Brian are lawyers, and Sarah is our paralegal.
Got it.
Great. And you have Andy and Tom?
Got Tom Santoro, yeah.
Great. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
So, Mr. Mikotis, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, you are.
Good. So I just wanted to start out with the preliminary introduction of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which I apologize to Dorothy, Andy, and Tom that they've already heard. The commission was established by Congress in May of last year to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. And one of the things that the statute asks the commission to investigate are companies that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. AIG falls in that category, so one of the things that we're looking at is what went wrong at AIG. The statute also specifically asks us to look at the role of complex financial derivatives in the financial crisis, so we are particularly interested in the role of the financial products unit in what happened at AIG and their use of derivatives, including but not limited to the credit default swap portfolio on multi-sector CDOs. So those are that's the background for why we wanted to talk to you today broadly, and I understand that you worked at the Financial Products Unit for several years. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Great. So Dorothy was able to send me your CV late last week. I just wanted to make sure that you had seen that and that it was correct.
She probably sent you what I sent her, so I'm sure it's correct.
Right, and but we redacted just a couple things so that they wouldn't be on the public record. So I told Dixie that if she wants to go over them on the phone, we can, but not when it's being tape recorded. So if you need some information afterwards from us, we can give that to you.
Great. We're hearing a little static on the line. Can you hear us? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, we were getting a little static on the line, so.
Oh.
Okay, great. No, I understand. The only thing it looks to me like you've redacted is things post-AIG. Is that right, Dorothy?
Oh, yes, as well as his address and that sort of thing, the personal details, and then the name of his current employer, yeah.
Okay. Is there any reason why you can't tell us the name of your current employer, Mr. Mikotis?
I would answer that just that, you know, the whole deal around bonuses and what have you, which Pierre handled extremely well, he doesn't need to have that information out in the public domain. He's not working for the British version of the CIA or anything really exciting.
No, but we'll tell you what it is. We just don't want it to be part of the public record, if that's at all possible.
Okay, that's fine. So, Dorothy, you and I can speak offline about it later.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. Great. So, just want to walk through your resume, mostly your experience at Financial Products. Mr. Mikotis, I see that you were the head of market risk management there starting in 1996 in Connecticut. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What were your job duties when you took that role?
My job duties were very varied, but if I can speak in general terms for now, You know, one responsibility I had was to monitor the portfolios, which, you know, consisted in on a daily basis looking at aggregate risk sensitivities across the transactions that we had done, so across our entire portfolio. Another responsibility was to review new transactions, which is something I did pretty much always before the transactions were done. You know, those were kind of the two main market risk responsibilities. We also, my team and I, had a responsibility for overseeing what we call the remark process, which was the process by which our traders updated the market parameters that were then used in the valuation of all the transactions. Even though officially my title was head of market risk for about 10 years, you know, from 1996, I've always done at least 50% of my time was devoted to operational risk type matters. So I was heavily involved in various processes that were implemented in the company and making sure that they operated properly. I was also, when I say I, myself, but also my team, obviously. We were also heavily involved in the development of our main system of to manage the portfolio, so value the transactions and generate all the risk sensitivities.
Could you say that again? You were involved in the development of...
Of the system. The system that we use to book our transactions and value them and calculate the risk sensitivities. We developed a lot of systems in-house at AIGFP. I was not involved in the development of all the systems, but the main system we use to book our transactions and value them is something I was, you know, myself and my team were heavily involved in.
Does it have a name internally?
That system was called Java.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Java?
Yeah.
J-A-V-A?
J-A-V-A-H.
J-A-V-A-H. Okay. So when you, I want to thank you for that. I appreciate it. I want to go back to the first job responsibility you listed, to monitor the portfolios on a daily basis and looking at aggregate risk sensitivities. What criteria would FP use, would your group use to monitor portfolios? In what ways would you analyze market risk? Were there particular buckets, particular markets that you knew FP had exposures to? And how did you sort of divide the world, so to speak?
Right. So the areas that we were monitoring were, you know, actively were anything to do with interest rate risk, foreign exchange risk, equity risk, and at, you know, later on, because we didn't have such exposures for many years, later on commodities. What we were not involved in was all the credit business and also all the transactions which brought some form of taxation risk to the company.
So, were you ever involved in the credit derivatives business in terms of providing risk management over that business before you became the chief risk officer of FP in 2007?
So I became the chief risk officer of FP towards the end of January 2007. And, you know, before that time, I was not involved in... you know, the credit transactions or the credit portfolio, apart from, you know, the very odd question, but nothing with the management of the book or the design of the transactions.
Who would have been in the risk management function over the credit derivatives book before you became chief risk officer in 2007, and if that person changed from when you joined FP or when you joined FP in 1996 until you became chief risk officer in 2007, I would appreciate you telling me everyone you remember.
Right. With respect to credit, the first important thing to mention is that, I mean, from day one of the existence of AIGFP, there were guidelines that AIG Inc., the parent, had provided to FP to conduct its credit business. And those guidelines basically told people which transactions they could do without a preliminary approval from the parent, and the rest, i.e. the transactions that required approval if the FP team deemed that those transactions were good transactions. So those guidelines were in place from day one, and they were they are still in place today. With respect to managing the credit risk within FP, that was, the two main people involved were originally when I started, Joe Cassano, since he was the person developing that business, and the then CEO, whose name is Tom Savage. Obviously there were also traders involved and marketing people in the transactions and managing the portfolio. But the two main people who were responsible and overseeing the risk were Tom and Joe. And when Tom Savage resigned and Joe Cassano became the CEO, Joe kept these responsibilities, and obviously Tom wasn't there. So you still had the channel with AIG, which, as I said, was there all along. And then Joe ultimately was the risk manager of, all the credit business.
Was Joe Cassano the ultimate risk manager for the other risk management, or for the other lines of business, the equities business, the currency business, the interest rate business?
No, I was the risk manager for those lines of business.
Why was it that FP did not have a separate risk management person over the credit book?
When AIGFP started to build its credit business, I had a discussion with the CEO at the time, Tom Savage, when I asked him what role he wanted me to play for this new business. And what he told me is that he had this business under his control, and he was, he decided that he would do the supervision and the monitoring of that portfolio, and discuss all these matters directly with Joe Cassano. Obviously, when Tom left, the role that Joe played remained, and he remained the ultimate, risk manager for that business.
When did Tom Savage leave?
I believe that was at the end of 2001.
What was your interaction with the parent company risk management department? Who did you report to when you became, so first of all, when you started as the market risk management, head of market risk management?
So I reported to Tom Savage. And then when Joe Cassano became the CEO, I reported to Joe Cassano.
And so as I understand it, just to walk through quickly, you started in Connecticut in 1996, you moved to London in 1999. Did any of your job responsibilities change when you moved to London?
No. No, I was, before that point, while I was in the U.S., and then when I was based in London, I was the head of market risk for AIGFP across all its subsidiaries, and that didn't change when I moved from the U.S. back to London. Just for completeness, I did work for AIGSP from the end of 92 to the end of 94, but I was not doing any, I didn't have a risk management function. I was part of the team that built models. Okay, but I'm saying that just for completeness.
I understand. Thank you for that. I saw that on your CV. So the entire time when you started in 1996 to when you became chief risk officer, you reported either to Tom Savage or to Joe Cassano that entire time?
When I became chief risk officer, I reported to Joe Cassano, and that happened, again, towards the end of January 2007.
Okay.
And also, I'd like to add something for completeness, and I will not remember when it started, but there was a point in time when a member of my team, the market risk team, attended the quarterly so-called second loss meeting, which was a meeting where the super senior portfolio was discussed. So it was not the entire credit business; it was confined to the super senior book.
I'm sorry. Where there was a point in time when a member of your team from the market risk team attended quarterly meetings. What did you say they were? Quarterly what meetings?
It was called the second loss.
Second loss.
And that was, so that was the internal name for that meeting. It was a quarterly meeting, which had started before the point where somebody from the market risk team, attended as an observer.
Were you ever the person who attended?
No, I used the rotation system, which generally I changed on an annual basis. So it's not just one person that attended those meetings. It's various people who rotated.
Do you have roughly any memory of when you would have started having someone attend these meetings? Can you give us any guide?
I don't have a rough idea. I mean, I tried to find a date because that came up in other discussions. I did not find a way to narrow down that date.
So, no way to say if it was between 2004 and 2006, if it would have been before that, if it would have been later?
I think it was after 2002.
After 2002?
Yeah.
Okay. And what were the names of the people that you sent?
I would have to go back to my notes to give you the exact names, because I haven't looked at that for some time, so I wouldn't want to give you names which are incorrect.
Okay.
But I'm happy to do that after this call and get you the information.
Great. Dorothy and Andy, if you could coordinate with Mr. Mikotis to get us those names, that would be wonderful.
How big was the team of probable candidates that you might have sent to the meeting? I mean, maybe we're talking about here.
Sorry, was that a question for me?
Yes, I'm sorry.
And what was the question?
How big was this team of folks that you rotated to attending these meetings?
How many people were on your market risk management team
that might have attended?
Yeah, so when I started in 96, there was nobody apart from me, so I was the head of myself. But I built a team from one person to nine people at the, when I left FP, there were nine people in market risk. And the number increased from, one to nine pretty constantly over the whole time, over the 12 years.
I want to clarify, you said from the very beginning 50% of your job was also operational risk management. On your resume, it lists you also, at least officially, becoming the head of operational risk management in July of 2006. Was that something that made that official, that you had been doing all along, or did you actually increase your job duties at that point?
No, my job duties increased. In particular, there was a new team that was created by myself in 2006. If I use the word operational, it kind of meant something quite different from 1996 to 2006 and then from 2006. You see, AIGFP, with respect to the equity markets, interest rates, foreign exchange, commodities, never took very large positions. So, you know, obviously we did still the monitoring of all the positions, but the core of the risk that I worried about and I monitored was, you know, as much of an operational nature as it was of a market nature. So, you know, when I started doing my job in 96, you know, as I explained earlier, I already had spent 2 years at AIGFP, so I knew the company reasonably well already. And I knew that I had to worry about operational matters. So that's what I meant when I said that 50% of my time was spent dealing with problems of an operational risk nature. But that became a formal responsibility of mine from 2006. And at that point, we did, you know, that team, that EU team I created, had responsibilities which were, you know, much closer to what operational risk teams do in other financial institutions.
And how many people would have been? How many people would have been in the operational risk team?
The peak was 4 people.
And before you created it in 2006, there was not a separate operational risk management function. Is that right?
Would you mind repeating the question, please?
Sure. My question is whether before 2006, anyone else held a role of risk management over operations, or whether that was something that you started. You said you started it, but I'm just wondering, was there anybody else who had any responsibility
no,
for it?
I was the first operational risk manager at AIGFP.
Thank you. I want to go back a little bit to what we were discussing about interaction with the risk management function of the parent company. If you could please describe for me when you were the head of market risk management, what interaction, if any, you had with the parent company's risk management function, which at some point in time came to be called enterprise risk management, although I'm not sure it was called that in 1996.
Right. Okay, so when I started in 1996, without remembering the date, I know it was very close to the first day I spent in the Wilson office as the head of market risk. I met the person that AIG was considering hiring to be their own head of market risk. That person's name is Chuck Lucas. So I met Chuck one day, and then AIG hired him as AIG Inc.'s head of market risk. And Chuck hired a bunch of people he knew to build his own team. So you see the processes for AIGFP and AIG on the timeline. And again, for the market risk, started around the same time. One of the people that Chuck Lucas hired, a fellow called Martin Meyer, is the person that Chuck put in charge of overseeing AIG financial products. So I spent a fair amount of time with Martin. Martin also made the arrange his agenda and his week to be able to spend as much time as possible on site in Westport. At the time, we were not based in Wilton, but Westport. So Martin was there fairly regularly. Him and I had various discussions about various topics. He participated to some internal AIGFP meetings. So all this to say that, you know, we had, we saw each other, you know, we had a lot of face-to-face discussions, and actually over these years I built a fairly good relationship with Martin, which lasted up to the last day I spent at AIG. Chuck Lucas had his own rotation, so after a few years, somebody else from his team was in charge of supervising AIGFP. You know, they all had their different styles. But, you know, we always had a good relationship, whether it's my team or myself. We always gave them everything they needed. You know, they were part of some of our regular and important internal meetings. They wrote their own memos, you know, things like that. So that's the kind of interaction we had. You know, I met Chuck Lucas from time to time when I went downtown. And, you know, certainly from my standpoint, I had a good relationship with Chuck Lucas. So that's really how I would describe the interaction. You know, and we gave them, you know, at the beginning we discussed what we could provide, what they were looking for, and we provided them periodic reports, information, stuff like that, that we sent every time they needed them. And there were also a bunch of reports that we sent periodically.
What were the periodic reports that you sent? Excuse me?
Be a good description of how things went on the market risk side, pretty much until the end.
Okay.
Until the end, I mean, until my last day there.
Until your last day there, including your time as the chief risk officer at FP.
Yeah, until July 3rd of 2009.
What were the periodic reports that you provided to AIG Inc.?
They were, I mean, there were various reports. I'm not going to remember them all.
Okay.
But, you know, one of them was a report that gave the results of the monitoring that I discussed before. So, you know, it was a report where you could see for various risk factors the net position across the book. You know, I know at some point we also implemented a value at risk report, and they got a copy of that. Again, I'm not going to remember everything they got. I mean, that's very easy to get from AIG and AIG FP. The people are still there. But, you know, it's that kind of information. And you know, also what I would say, they had, you know, fairly regularly questions about things they had heard during meetings or, you know, things they've heard through some channel. You know, we had a very open dialogue, and every time Martin or his successors had questions for us, you know, we gave the answers and all the information they needed.
Do you remember who Martin's successors were?
I don't remember, I won't remember all the names. There was somebody called Dimitri Lorenzen.
Who? Dimitri?
Dimitri Lorenzen. I think it's L-O-R-E-N-Z-O-N.
Okay.
And then there was somebody called Jamie Bolton, B-O-L-T-O-N. I think there may have been somebody else, but the name escapes me.
And would Martin Mayer and his successors have also, in the course of overseeing FP, have also overseen risk management on the credit derivatives portfolio?
So, I mean, here, it's hard for me to answer because there were clearly topics for which Martin Mayer, I mean, and I just remember that from the old years, there were things that Martin were investigating which were not in my jurisdiction, so things like credit. That for sure happened, but, you know, you would have to speak to, you know, Martin and the relevant people at AIG to get a clear and precise answer to that question. And also, you know, with respect to credit, AIG had, you know, prior to the birth of the market risk team, you know, when they hired Chuck Lucas, they had their credit risk team, which obviously was very involved in anything to do with credit, you know, credit transactions and credit portfolio. And that, you know, that was separate from market risk, but that existed, you know, before 1996. It existed all along, you know, all along meaning from the first day of AIGSP.
Did you ever interact with Bob Lewis?
I did interact with Bob Lewis from 2000 and, you know, the end of 2007. But, you know, I knew Bob, he knew me, we met on a few occasions, you know, over time. He was not somebody with whom I interacted directly the most. You know, Bob had, over the years, spoken a lot to Joe Cassano. So, you know, Joe Cassano would be the main person that Bob would speak to rather than me, but our dialogue increased as my own responsibilities increased.
Did you ever interact with the legal department?
Which one, FPs or AIGs?
Both. I was specifically wondering about FPs and wondering if you ever would have reviewed any derivatives contracts to assess any risk that may have been inherent to those contracts.
So I interacted with virtually every team within FP, even though, as I discussed earlier, there were certain things that were not in my jurisdiction. There were always some sort of topic that I discussed and made me interact with everybody. And obviously, I spent a significant amount of time with various members of the legal team on all sorts of matters. And I have reviewed a very long list of transactions, derivative transactions, with members of the legal team over the years.
So who in the legal department would you have primarily interacted with?
There's nobody in particular. I interacted with a lot of them. Whoever the lawyer was assigned to the transactions that I, or the business that I was kind of investigating or looking at.
So you would have gotten briefings from the legal department on various aspects of the contracts?
Yeah, we don't call them... I mean, it depends what you mean by briefing. I mean, typically, what would happen is one of the front office people, most likely a marketer or trader, would bring to my team or myself, would bring to our attention a new transaction or a matter relating to an existing transaction. And when the case arised, we needed some legal briefing or explanations. At that point, I would interact with the legal team, or myself. Again, when I say I, most of the time I'm talking about myself or the marketers.
But I assume you would not have interacted with the legal department on any of the credit derivative deals. Is that right?
Well, if I want to give a 100% accurate answer, I have interacted with some of the legal people about credit derivative transactions simply because we had a process called trade review. Trade review was a process that FP had from day one, which consisted in putting members of the various teams within FP together each day to review all the transactions that were done during the day and make sure that they were booked correctly in the system. So as part of that process, which I was involved in, like pretty much all my colleagues, we would check that certain credit transactions were booked in the system, and that required sometimes a discussion with the legal team. But, I did not, prior to the end of January 2007, discuss with a member of the legal team about the structuring of a transaction for which I had to kind of bless or turn down. If you see the difference.
Yes. Was there a formal approval process for FP business units to go through your department in order to get deals signed off on? Was there a threshold, or did you have to review and sign off on every deal that fell into the interest rate, currency, equities, commodity buckets?
We were involved. I believe I'm a fairly hands-on person. So my team and I participated to many internal meetings. We heard about a lot of trades. People gave us a heads up. We reviewed everything we could, that was brought to our attention or we heard about, just to be ready to either raise issues that we saw or be ready to approve a transaction so that the team could move forward on a timely basis. So that process, you use the word formal. That formal process existed, and we were very proactive to be involved in any transaction that ultimately falls within our jurisdiction.
My question is simply whether the business units were required to get your approval, whether that was formal or informal.
Yes. Yeah, there were cases where no approval was necessary on a specific transaction because it fell under the umbrella of an approval that was given prior for a certain number of transactions or a certain notional, things like that. But you know, FP, the FP team was rather small, so we were involved in things at a very granular level. And I would tend to give my sign-off almost transaction by transaction.
Were the FP business units responsive to suggestions made by your group?
Yes.
Was there ever a time when they were not?
When they were not, and you know, it's all a question of our you know, internal threshold of materiality. You know, sometimes we had a strong view about a minor part of a transaction, and you know, if people resisted and we felt that we could live with it, then we would accept, you know, the fact that people didn't want to make the change that ideally we would have wanted. But on anything material, if people were resisting for whatever reason or had a different opinion, ultimately this thing would be a discussion between Joe and I, and more likely than not, the members of the team. And that happened fairly regularly too. You know, and I think this is a kind of a normal process. So, you know, ultimately, if there was a big disagreement on something that I found was material, that would turn into a discussion with Joe Cassano, and then we would decide as a team what we could do to move forward in a way that I was comfortable.
Before you became chief risk officer, and so I'm focusing on the time period when you would have been the head of market risk management in London, and Joe Cassano at this point would have been the CEO of FP, and thus would have been serving also the risk management function over the credit derivatives business. Did you and Mr. Cassano ever have discussions, trade notes on risk management issues related to what was in your purview versus what was under his purview?
I think the perimeter was reasonably clear. We didn't always agree on certain matters, which, you know, were clearly matters that fell under my jurisdiction. I think we were pretty good at discussing those things and coming up with a good compromise.
My question is really more, did you and Mr. Cassano ever have discussions where he came to you, for example, and said, you know, we're seeing these issues in the super senior credit derivatives portfolio. Do you have any input given your expertise in market risk management? That sort of thing.
Really the main moment when that happened was after we got the first collateral call from Goldman Sachs.
But not before then.
July 2007. I mean, that's really, frankly, the only moment where Joe came to me and other people and basically said, if you want, the situation was, I need help from you guys. You know, you have the experience, the knowledge in matters that now we're going to have to deal with for the super senior portfolio. Prior to that, you know, apart from kind of very episodic conversations which, you know, were not of any materiality, there was no example of what you're asking.
So other than the quarterly meetings where a member of your team would sit in on a discussion of the super senior credit derivative portfolio, you had virtually no interaction with or knowledge of that business? Is that right?
The answer is different, whether it's knowledge or interaction. You know, knowledge, you also have to add two main forums. There was something called the Global Call, which in the old days was a weekly conference call which involved all the offices, so, you know, Tokyo, Europe, and the U.S., where various topics were discussed, including the transactions that had been done since the last meeting and the potential transactions. And clearly, during that forum, all the credit-related transactions were discussed. although in a fairly kind of, you know, very general terms, but you could see what was on the, what was pointing on the horizon, close or distant. And then we had another regional meeting called the BDM, Business Development Meeting, which was a weekly meeting. So this time it was a face-to-face, it was not a conference call, although technically for Europe we had a video link with the Paris office between Paris and London. And during that forum, we would discuss, or the marketers would present their business, discuss the transactions they were looking at, including credit transactions, and they would go into a little bit more detail what, you know, what they were looking at. So in terms of information knowledge, I, like all my colleagues, had additional information about all sorts of trades in those forums. But with respect to interaction, you know, participating to the structuring of a transaction, being asked questions about whether I was comfortable or what, no, I mean, that point is, you know, after the end of January 2007.
In your experience as a risk manager, was it typical to have risk management functions performed by heads of business units?
Well, you know, given what I said earlier, all, you know, the other areas were areas where the risk management function had, you know, intervened or interacted with the rest of the teams in a fashion that was close or identical to what happens in most other institutions. But, you know, for credit, again, there was this, list of rules and this channel with AIG Inc. from day one. And even though I was not myself involved, all the transactions that did not satisfy all the rules of the guidelines, and that must have included all the super senior transactions, where AIG SP formally requested the approval from AIG Inc., wrote a detailed memo, and lengthy discussions, phone conversations followed. So even if I was not involved, there was a risk management function playing its role. You know, it just so happened it was done by AIG Inc. and not by my team. So for the institution, the model was the same as the model that I think you're referring to.
Okay, thank you. It's my understanding that all of the financial product units, derivatives books, for example, interest rate and currency and the other ones you mentioned, were fully hedged books, except for the credit derivative portfolio. Is that correct, to your knowledge?
I mean, it's you know, I've seen that statement. It's not correct. What is a correct statement is to say that within the market, you know, within the other businesses or the other underlyings, so again, interest rates, foreign exchange, equities, and commodities, the approach was to take very little first order risk. So to be clear, you know, if equity markets would move around their current level, up or down, same for interest rates, same for FX, same for commodities, the change in value of the portfolio of FP would be very immaterial. However, we had exposures to things like implied volatility, implied correlations, things like that, where we had open exposures for certain periods of time. We didn't hedge everything simply because you cannot run a derivatives book and hedge everything. So we had open risks, mostly in things like volatility and correlation. Whereas, you know, on the credit risk side, the positions that were taken were mostly of a first order risk nature, but on exposures that were deemed to be extremely safe. I'm putting, we had an asset book where the proposition is different there, but I'm putting that aside for the moment. And, if I focus on the super senior, it was much more first order risk, but on things that were deemed to be very safe, very, very safe.
So if I could just tell you what I understood from that is that the interest rate, currency, commodities, and equities derivatives books were hedged in the sense that they didn't take any, or if they took little, if any, first-order risk, but that they you had open exposures to things like implied volatility and implied correlation, but that the credit book actually had first-order exposure, and it wasn't hedged in that first instance. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, but again, and if we talk specifically about the super senior book, that those first order risk exposures were on underlying credits that were deemed to be very safe. So the transactions were structured such that the exposure was on credits that were very safe.
Could you maybe, this is something I'm not fully, I don't fully understand. Could you explain to me what it means to have exposure to implied volatility?
Sure. We, as part of our business, we did a lot of exchange-traded or over-the-counter options. And when you sell or buy such a financial product, you are exposed to the market's view of what the volatility of the underlying of the option, whatever it is going to be between now and the expiry of the option. And this parameter is called the implied volatility.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And implied correlation, similarly, could you explain?
Yeah, it's the same concept, except for a product where you typically would have more than one underlying. So, for instance, a basket of equities or things like that. The value of the derivative would be a function also of projected correlations between the various underlyings, for instance.
The value of the derivative.
The value of the transaction, yeah. The value of the derivative transaction would be a function of the market's anticipation of the correlation between all the various underlyings that the derivative refers to.
Okay, thank you. Were you aware in participating in the global calls or otherwise that AIGFP had made a decision in early 2006 to stop writing CDS protection on multi-sector CDOs with exposure to subprime United States real estate assets?
I was aware of that, and I think it would be hard to work at FP and not know that because it was mentioned very often.
And during what time period did you first become aware of that?
You know, the, I mean, first of all, I was not part of the discussions of, you know, I'm not even sure as of today exactly what happened and who did what. But and I cannot tell you exactly when I heard about it for the first time, but if I had to guess, you know, it was towards the late 05, because the message internally was, late 05, because the message was that we were going to stop to write that business. However, for all the transactions that were on the pipeline, we were going to honor our all commitments. So kind of late 05, beginning of 06.
Were there any discussions about sharing these concerns with other parts of AIG?
Yes.
Were you involved in any discussions with people at AIG Inc.?
No.
So what were the discussions that you took part in or were aware of?
I didn't take part of any discussions. What I'm aware of is that when the FP team, including Joe Cassano, had concluded that the underwriting standards, in particular in the subprime subprime mortgage business had deteriorated to an extent where people were not comfortable that they could really model those transactions. When they reached that conclusion, they let AIG Inc. know of their decision, and they also let all the market counterparties with which AIGFP was doing these trades know as well.
And was there any discussion with NFP about hedging the credit derivative book at that point, the super senior book?
again, I mean, no, this is not a topic that I've ever been involved in, but, you know, I have overheard or, you know, or heard of discussions that did happen, you know, with some of my colleagues on that topic. But personally, I was not involved, and I'm afraid that there's nothing I can say apart from, you know, hearsay or stuff I've read in the press subsequently.
So there wasn't any discussion of it at the global calls, for example?
You know, this is a bit of a difficult question because, you know, I've participated to so many global calls and we talk about so many different topics, but, you know, no, I don't recall that being a topic of discussion during a global call or any other call, you know, any other kind of, you know, periodic meeting.
Okay, thanks. I'd like to move forward a little bit now and talk about what happened starting in 2007. And I believe, as you said, you became CRO of FP in late January of 2007. So this would, you know, starting after you became chief risk officer. And I'm not sure I covered this earlier. Would you mind giving me just, again, a brief description of your job duties as chief risk officer, how they changed from when you were the head of risk, market risk management?
Right. So I was the head of market risk management until sometime in 2006, which is when we had discussions about operational risk, and I suggested and did create an operational risk team. So from that point, I managed two teams, and towards the end of the year, there was a departure and some restructuring of responsibilities, and Joe Cassano asked me, end of January 2007, whether I would accept to have the credit risk team under my responsibilities, which I accepted. So that means, practically speaking, that I had more people who reported to me that I had to know better, since I knew pretty much all of them, but you know better, know what they were doing and how, manage that team, and also you know, learn a great deal about the credit book and the business and the risk.
All right, excuse me, you said end of 2007. I think you meant end of 2006.
So from the end of January 2007, I meant.
Okay.
Sorry.
And there was a team that was already under Cassano working on credit risk management when you became CRO?
So, there was a team. There was a credit risk management team for us. I mean, certainly when I joined, at the end of 92, there was a team, a credit risk team, already. Okay, so that existed before I created the market risk team. And that team, up to the end of January 2007, did not report directly to Joe Cassano. It reported to somebody called Doug Pauling.
So earlier you were saying that Tom Savage and then Joe Cassano headed credit risk management. Is that right?
Well, you know, that's what I meant is those were the kind of ultimate people who made the decision with respect to the credit risk that FP would take.
But Doug Pauling was the head of credit risk management?
They were the people who, in practice, were the risk managers of the credit book at FP.
So what was Doug Pauling's job function?
Doug Pauling, I'm not going to remember the total extent of his responsibilities, but the legal team reported to him. He was the general counsel for, you know, for a while as well. The back office team reported to him, and the credit risk team reported to him. So that was just before the changes in responsibilities that happened at the end of January 2007.
And of the credit risk team, who would have been the most senior person on that credit risk team?
The head of the team at that point was called Ed Diaz.
Ed Diaz. And how long, from what time period was Ed Diaz in that position?
I That's something I can find. I don't have that at the top of my head.
Okay, that's fine.
I don't remember who was hired because, you know, I didn't hire him.
Okay, but he was there from, say, sort of 2004 to 2007?
Probably something like that. But, you know, I don't remember the year when he was hired.
Was he still there when you took over as chief risk officer?
Yes. Ed reported to me from the end of January 2007.
Okay. So, starting in 2007, were you aware of AIG, the parent company, starting to ask for information on FP's subprime exposures? And I would bookend this by saying, were you aware of that at any point prior to learning about the first collateral call coming in late July?
You know, I'm aware that AIG had various, you know, requests for information or data or things like that, whether it's market risk or credit risk, because that was kind of part of the day-to-day. I remember once, so that between the end of January 2007 and kind of the summer of 2007, I remember going to New York for a CRC, Credit Risk Committee, a CRC meeting where there was a presentation about the super senior book, and I'm pretty sure that there was a part, you know, a section about the subprime part of the portfolio. I think that was the only CRC I attended to.
Why did you attend that one, if you remember?
Well, you know, I had taken my new responsibilities fairly recently. I don't remember how often the CRC was held, to be honest. And also remember, I was based in London, and the CRC was happening in the U.S. And also Ed was, you know, the main person involved in all these meetings and all these discussions. So you know, I think I just went because it would make sense for me to be part of a CRC meeting at some point. I did not present anything during that meeting. It was more like an observer. You know, and I also started to have, you know, discussions from time to time with Kevin McGinn. So he was the head of the credit risk team at AIG. So, you know, it just made sense for me to be involved in those processes from time to time.
Before you went to this CRC meeting where the subprime part of the super senior portfolio was discussed, did you have any, let me back up. So I guess you said you were aware that FP exited the business of writing CDS on CDOs containing subprime exposure in starting late 05. And then sometime between January of 2007 and the summer of 2007, you attended a CRC meeting in New York where FP's exposure to subprime was discussed. Before that meeting, but subsequent to learning about FP exiting subprime, sort of earlier in 2007, was there other discussion of subprime, or was this really when it started to come up and become a topic of discussion, so to speak?
I can't really answer that question because I was not, certainly with respect to the parent, not yet in the flow of information or, you know, in the flow of discussion. And, you know, what I remember of that CRC meeting was not a deep concern about the subprime positions either at AIG or at SP. So it was more of a kind of, you know, update on the portfolio rather than a deep concern. I mean, that's what I remember about it.
But you wouldn't have been involved in collecting any of the information for that discussion or for other requests for information that AIG received?
No, because, I mean, anything like that would be a discussion between Kevin McGinn and Ed.
And Ed Diaz.
Yeah, and Ed Diaz, yes. And, you know, Ed would tell me you know, it would give me a kind of a heads up that something's happening. Or if he runs into any kind of problem and needed my help, then he would contact me. But I would not be, I mean, obviously things changed a lot after the first Goldman collateral call, but up to that point, you know, I was kind of at the periphery of what was happening with respect to AIG's request.
So even though Ed Diaz worked for you, Kevin McGinn would have gone, may have kept you in the loop, but would have gone directly to Ed Diaz for information.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the way, you know, and I had that discussion with Kevin and Ed. You know, they got along very well. They've known each other for a while. I think there was a lot of mutual respect. And I didn't see any reason why I should break that. When I met with Kevin the first time, which was after the end of January 2007, you know, the things that we discussed where he needed my help had nothing to do with super senior or the subprime or anything like that. You know, there were things where he asked that I, you know, be proactive to make things happen. But they were nothing to do with a subprime or super senior. And Ed, you know, we agreed with Ed that if one day there would be an issue and he felt he didn't get what he needed, he would call me direct. And that was fine. And, you know, and he did that on a couple of occasions. But, you know, it was because people were busy more than, you know, people not giving the information he needed. So that's really how things worked. Again, Ed and Kevin had worked together for a while, and they spoke very regularly.
You've mentioned a few times the collateral calls. When were you first notified about the first collateral call that Goldman Sachs, I believe, made for over $1 billion?
I was towards the end of July.
Is it your understanding that you were notified right around the time that the call came in?
I think I was notified fairly rapidly after Goldman Sachs you know, mentioned that to the trader. I don't remember who heard about it for the first time.
Who was it who notified you about the call?
I believe it was Joe.
And what did he say to you about it?
He mentioned, again, from what I remember, he mentioned that Goldman had made a significant collateral call on the subprime portion of the super senior book. And, you know, frankly, at that point, there was still a lot of unknowns, you know. I'm not sure that they had made I don't remember whether it was the official collateral call or if they gave us a heads up, you know, because I was not in the detailed conversations, but Joe kind of told me that that was a new event. I wanted me to be aware of it.
Were you surprised?
Yes, I was surprised.
Why were you surprised?
You know, the main thing is to go from zero to over $1 billion is always surprising. Now, I know the portfolio is very large, but it just felt like a very kind of digital kind of event.
It felt what? I'm sorry?
Very digital, like, you know, from nothing to a very big number.
We're still not hearing the word, Pierre. What's the word you just...
It's nothing to a very big number. Sort of huge and out of the blue.
The word I... Very digital.
Digital.
Yeah.
Had you been aware of the contractual provisions that required the posting of collateral upon a decline in the market value of the underlying securities?
No, I was not. At that time, I was not.
Did Mr. Cassano indicate to you whether or not he had been aware of these provisions in the contract prior to that first collateral call coming in?
Okay, so it's difficult for me to answer, and that's not a new topic. You know, all I can say is I've heard Joe more than once express his surprise by you know, what SP had accepted to do with respect to those collateral provisions. I cannot say that he didn't know at all that they were under collateral, but maybe he wasn't. You see, again, this portfolio was built without my involvement. You know, I didn't look at those transactions. I certainly didn't know that important feature. And I never had a clear discussion with Joe Cassano where he told me I absolutely didn't know. You know, Joe Cassano was very hands-on, a very hands-on manager. So on one hand, it's very difficult to imagine he didn't know, but, you know, he expressed a surprise more than once when I was in the room about certain features of those collateral provisions.
Would any of the contracts for interest rate or equity or commodity derivatives have similar features?
Yeah, very common.
So could you describe them a little bit more to me so I can I'm trying to put in context these collateral provisions that were in the super senior credit derivative contracts in terms of how standard they were or were not in other derivative contracts?
Well, you know, these clauses are very standard. I mean, generally what happens is when two firms decide that they want to do derivative business together, OTC derivative business together, they generally negotiate an agreement called a CSA, which, you know, is like any other contract with a certain number of rules, you know, what one counterparty can post as collateral and what it cannot and things like that, and haircuts and frequency of posting collateral, you know, all these rules. And although not all transactions fall under CSA, most do, especially the transactions with market participants.
And the CSA is a credit support annex?
Yeah.
And
it doesn't mean that you will post collateral straight away, because sometimes it's conditional on whatever, you know, like your rating or other features. There's all sorts of variations possible.
So,
however,
go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
You know, however, those transactions, I cannot say all of them, but pretty much all of them had specific collateral language in the confirmation of the transaction. So, you know, that's not completely unusual, but it's certainly not the norm.
You're talking about the super senior transactions now.
The super senior with subprime. So when you look at the legal document that explains how the transaction works, so it says, you know, trade date and maturity, notional.
The confirmation.
There were a couple of paragraphs that explain how the collateral would work. So it was in the transaction confirmation rather than being dealt by an overall CSA. So again, you know, not unheard of, but not the norm. So there were specific rules that were applied to a specific transaction, and, you know, they differed across dealers. So, you know, what FP had agreed to with, say, Merrill Lynch was different from what it had agreed to with Goldman Sachs. And there were also differences for the same dealer, but across deals. So they were all negotiated deal by deal.
So what I heard you say is that the collateral clauses are very standard across different types of derivative contracts, be they credit or commodities, etc. What I'm specifically wondering, and I understand that there are general collateral provisions in all of these derivative contracts, what I'm specifically curious about is whether other derivative contracts typically have provisions that require posting of collateral upon a decline in sort of the mark-to-market values of underlying assets. I understand that might not be sort of a directly relevant question for something like an interest rate derivative, but I'm wondering from the equities or commodities perspective whether that particular type of collateral provision would have been standard or not.
yeah, it would be standard, but and frankly, it's also standard for most, you know, for credit default swap transactions on, say, a corporate name. But again, you know, with respect to the senior, the super senior book, you know, I think if you had asked people, you know, at random within FP, whether they thought that those transactions fell under a collateral agreement, I think most people would have expected no.
Why was that?
Because again, those deals were structured to you know, such that FP would write protection on very safe underlyings, you know, meaning rock solid, can withstand all sorts of recession periods and things like that. And it just, you know, it was just not intuitive that those deals would have a collateral agreement. And, you know, again, I cannot speak about that directly because I was not involved in these discussions, but what I know after the fact was that there were, I understand, pretty lengthy discussions with the counterparties about whether FP would or would not accept to have collateral provisions on those transactions. Like, typically, the monolines who did similar business did not collateralize those transactions.
So when you looked into this, or when you had discussions after the fact, what did you learn about who was involved in negotiating those provisions with the counterparties in those lengthy discussions that they had?
All I know is that there, you know, the number of transactors on FP side were, you know, the list is very short. I believe that the list of legal people is also very short. The bulk of the book was built by, you know, really a handful of people. And with respect to who made the decision to accept and all that, I, you know, sincerely don't know. And that's a question I personally am interested in too, but I do not know.
But you heard that there were long discussions with the counterparties about these provisions.
Oh yeah, that was after the fact, you know. I mean, that was after the first collateral call.
Do you remember anybody telling you who would have had the lengthy discussions with the counterparties?
Yeah, it would be people like Alan Frost, mainly. But, you know, it's, again, I don't have first-hand information. I don't feel I'm the right person to, you know, to answer these questions, but that's kind of the kind of discussion I had internally after, you know, after the end of July 2007.
Okay. What about Andrew Forster?
Yes.
Would he have been involved, to your knowledge?
I do not know.
Okay.
I do not know the extent. You know, that became a sensitive topic, obviously, and, you know, it's the kind of discussion where it's very hard to get to the bottom of what happened. I, you know, obviously, what I can tell you is that Andrew Forster had a lot more information about those collateral provisions than I had, but I do not know when he first heard about them. I do not know whether he knew about them when Goldman made the first call. I do not know. What I know as well, he expressed surprise, like Joe did, at certain of the features of those collateral provisions. But I do not know exactly when he was made aware, or whether he approved, or what was his involvement. I do not know.
Can I ask a clarifying question? You said there were lengthy conversations with the counterparties about the collateral provisions, but do you mean after the collateral calls, or do you mean during the negotiation of the contract?
I met the latter, but it's true for both, as you can imagine.
Sure. I was just making sure that that's what you meant, that you had just heard.
No, I meant when the deals were negotiated.
Pierre.
You know, one thing, as I said, the fact that the monoline did those transactions with no collateral provisions, or very different, you know, or safer collateral provisions. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I was referring to.
Here, let me just ask you really quickly to clarify one thing. To the extent that we're dealing not with the post-collateral calls, once calls were made and negotiations, set those aside. Focus yourself exclusively on the process by which the collateral agreements were negotiated, if they were negotiated at all, and entered into. Do you know anything about how much time was put into them? For example, do you know if there were laborious back-and-forth negotiations over the document, or if the document, on the other hand, was just sort of punched out as a standard piece of paper?
I don't know, Andy. I was not part of the discussion, so I cannot say it.
Okay.
You just heard later that these discussions had taken place.
That's right.
Okay, thank you. Before the first collateral call came in, to your knowledge, did FP value its super senior credit default swap book on a regular basis?
So the accounting treatment of the super senior portfolio, including the part that was on subprime underlying, was valued at the transaction price. That's the accounting approach that everybody was aware of, and I'm talking about, you know, the parents also and the auditors, and that's the accounting approach that that was accepted and signed off. However, when the FAS 157 standard was adopted, as part of that, certain modification of some of the internal meetings that we had were made to kind of review whether there was any anything in the market that people had seen that could invalidate that decision. So
it wasn't to, it wasn't that
transaction. There was no particular model in place. Because those transactions were valued at the transaction price, but there was a process which was kind of a quarterly process, such that, you know, people had to think about whether they'd seen anything in the market that would then conclude that the transaction price was not appropriate anymore.
Well, was there a meeting that went with this quarterly process?
So, for instance, the second loss business that I mentioned earlier was modified so that on its agenda there was a, you know, one of the topics was to discuss whether there was any evidence in the market that those transactions could not anymore be valued at their transaction price.
Do you remember when that agenda item was added?
Not at the top of my head.
Would it have been before the collateral call came in July of 07?
Yes.
Would it have been
before? It was in place in 2007. I don't remember exactly when it was put in place. It was not something that was there for like 5 years. You know, it was more, you know, it could have been the end of, it could even have been the end of 06. But I don't have the, I don't have that date at the top of my head.
Okay. Was the Gorton model ever used in the valuation process or in assessing this on a quarterly basis?
Yes, the Gorton model was used periodically, at least quarterly, to confirm that all transactions were still, from a credit standpoint, at the super senior standard. And that was the condition that had to be satisfied to be able to apply the valuation, you know, the valuation at the transaction price. Also, if a transaction was deemed not to be totally super senior, the model could indicate where the attachment point ideally should be for the transaction to be deemed to be super senior, and the little slice of non-super senior risk would have to generally be hedged. So if I take an example, I look at a transaction, attachment point is 10%, and that's a super senior transaction according to Gary Colton's model and all his assumptions. The transaction is closed. Periodically, the Gary-Galton model is run, and if the Gary-Galton model says The attachment point now needs to be 11%. So there's a little tranche from 10 to 11% that is not super senior anymore, and typically that would have to be hedged by the ESP team.
How would they go about hedging that 1%?
You would do, so it's kind of, you know, in my particular example, it's a very thin mezzanine tranche. So it attaches at somewhere, non-zero, and it detaches at lower than 100%. So you would typically try to do that transaction with a market counterparty. Or you know, you would structure a bond or something like that, which would refer to that portfolio and specifically to the tranche that is not deemed to be super senior. And those kinds of trades were done by the team, you know, from time to time. You know, it was not, it didn't happen often that, you know, this kind of configuration happened, but when it did happen, typically the team would try to hedge that slice.
So basically they would enter into a credit default swap transaction where they're the buyer of protection rather than the seller of protection.
That was the idea. That was the idea.
And you said that FAS 157, that you revisited if, whether there was any market information that should change the assessment that these transactions could be held at par on your books. And I'm just wondering whether it was the understanding of the team at FP that FAS 157 would require it to mark the assets to market, whether or not anything in the market had changed.
Well, you know, what I referred to and the way the meetings were changed, if you want, that was an accounting requirement that you had to have that, you know, and they would be in an audit trail and that it would be specifically on an agenda. I mean, obviously, these discussions took place before the adoption of that standard, you know, when the discussions with PwC happened. You know, typically, that would always be a topic, you know, as the world changed, is the approach still valid?
I see. So even before FAS 157 came on the scene, these discussions were taking place.
I'm sorry?
I said, what I think I heard you say is that even before FAS 157 came on the scene, these discussions were taking place.
It's not, to be clear, it's not discussions that I participated to, but, you know, it was part of the agenda of things that were discussed with the auditors all along. To my knowledge.
One question I have is whether the company would have been required to develop a model to value the super senior CDS transactions under FAS 157, even if the market hadn't changed.
You know, I am not, you know, I'm not an accountant and I don't know the standard that well to answer that question. You know, clearly all those transactions were done, I mean, there was no real market observable for all those transactions. A lot of them were, you know, the word has been used a lot, bespoke. And, you know, frankly, that's how the book was valued in agreement with AIG Inc. and the auditors up to that point. But, you know, whether FAS 157 requires you to have a model to value the transactions, even though you value them with the transaction price, that I cannot speak to that. I don't know.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. I believe, I shared with Dorothy something that I'm certain that she probably shared with you, and it's a memo that you wrote called Goldman Sachs Collateral Disagreement Observations and Conclusions, by Pierre Mikotis as of December 20th, 2007. Do you remember that? Did she share that with you recently?
Yeah, but I'm very familiar with this memo.
Okay, great. And I'm assuming from this that you had some involvement in the collateral disputes between AIGFP and Goldman Sachs, and I was wondering if, just going backwards in time, you could give us a little bit of detail on your level of involvement. We're interested in the story and what happened, but I wanted to know first how you were involved in what happened with the collateral disputes.
So with respect to the collateral dispute, what I was not involved in was the discussions with the camp parties themselves about, you know, whether AIGFP would agree to post X or Y or Z. Those discussions took place between the traders at SP and the traders at Goldman Sachs. There were also discussions between Joe Cassano himself and various people at Goldman Sachs. So, you know, those conversations I was not part of. However, what I was part of was there was a series of conference calls with Goldman Sachs, mainly. There was one with Merrill Lynch as well. So there were conference calls not to talk about what amount FP would agree to post or not to post, but to talk about market color, modeling approaches, views, things like that. So kind of with respect to the collateral calls, I was involved in kind of gathering information about what others' views were, if that makes sense.
And when would these series of conference calls with Goldman Sachs and one with Merrill Lynch have taken place?
So, I mean, we can give you all the dates. The first one with Goldman Sachs was on November 5th, 2007.
Okay.
And the last one was in March, sometime in March 2008. 14th of March, 2008.
And roughly how many calls would there have been total?
I think, just looking at some notes here. I think there were six or seven.
Do you have a list of them?
Yeah.
Can we have that?
Dorothy?
Sorry, Pierre, is this a list that you've made up yourself?
The question is,
that's the list we discussed in the past.
Pierre, let's slow down. Is this a list, I don't care who made it up, that was done while you were at AIG for AIG purposes, then fine, Dixie should have it. In contrast, if it's a list you made up afterwards or in connection with our work with you and representing you, we shouldn't provide it. So which is it?
You know, I'm referring to the collateral calls that I'm referring to the conference calls we had with Goldman and that, you know, we've discussed before.
That right. Sounds like a primary document that's AIG that you have a copy of.
But wait a minute. The list
the conference calls we had with Goldman and we've discussed in the past.
Right, but the question is, the list that you're referring to when you came up with those dates, is this a list that you created in connection with this investigation or this inquiry, or is it something you had written at the time they were going on?
You know, I don't mean to trip this up too much, but suffice to say, if the list is an AIG list, we'd certainly like it. If it is a list that McAtees had developed in conjunction with our inquiry that you feel we're not entitled to, we'd certainly like all of the documents that were relied upon in creating the list, which presumably were AIG documents.
All right, we'll talk about this afterwards with Pierre and figure this out.
Yeah, Dixie, it wouldn't have been a list created for your process. It would have been one created for prior processes.
Okay, and would it be okay just for now, Mr. Mikotis, if you could just list the seven dates? That way we at least have that information.
Dixie, let's hold on that. Let's sort out whether it was produced for purposes of his representation or not.
Okay.
If it was, we should hold on to it. If it wasn't, we'll get it to you forthwith.
Okay, great. That's fine. I'm going to put you guys on mute for just give me 2 minutes, okay?
But wait, Dixie, how much more do you have?
I think we had 2 hours scheduled for this, right?
Yeah.
So I think
Maybe we could take like a 10-minute break or something.
And then dial back in?
Well, okay.
Yeah, we'll just put you on hold for a full 5 minutes starting now.
Okay,
five
great.
Minutes.
Thanks.
Okay.
The recorder's still on, so I'm going to turn it off.
Just the red record button.
Nicole, it's announced by Linda. Okay?
Okay.
Hold on one.
Okay, we'll wait for you.
I apologize. I disconnected us.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. Hello? Sorry?
Yeah, this is Pierre. I'm on too.
Wonderful. So, did you guys
one thing before you going. At the very end, Pierre will drop off. We want to speak to you about another client. It'll take less than 2 minutes. Okay?
Sure. That's fine. That's fine. So, Mr. Mikotis, back to the conference calls that we were discussing earlier with Goldman Sachs and then one with Merrill Lynch. Who was on those calls for FP?
There was more than one call, and it was never exactly the same team.
Okay, so if you could maybe just list all the people who would have been involved in any of the calls.
Okay, I mean, there was one, there's going to be a rather long list of people then, because there was one meeting with Goldman Sachs, which involved a lot of people, including people from AIG.
Okay, and so who would have been, it's fine to separate that one out if you want to tell us who would have been the larger group that would have been involved in that one versus the core people who would have been involved in all of them.
Okay, so kind of a typical attendance on the FP side would be, in addition to myself, to the meetings I participated to, would be Andy Forster. Tom Pewing.
Pierre, can you stop a bit?
Oh, you can't hear me?
Yeah.
You can now.
I heard Tom Pewing.
Tom Pewing. James Bridgewater. And Peter Robinson. But again, you know, it was never quite the same group of people for each call.
And the larger group that you had for one call, was that later in the period? Like sort of, like in 2008?
Yeah, it was in 2008.
And who was on the phone from the FP or from the AIG side then?
I don't have, you know, I would have to look at the records. I don't have the list of people in mind.
But sure.
There was a rather long list of people.
Just from your memory, if you could give me a sense of some of the people you remember.
So, you know, some of the people I just mentioned, I think, would have been on the call. I think there was David Herzog from AIG. I believe Bob Lewis from AIG was there. You know, then I'm just going to kind of do wild guesses.
No, Pierre, no wild guesses.
No, so that's what I'm going to do, because I don't quite remember.
All right, if you don't remember, you don't remember.
And who are the two? Yep, go ahead.
If you need us to find a document that lists them, we could do that.
Okay, yes, that would be wonderful, thanks.
Okay.
And then typically who would be involved on the Goldman side?
Again, it varied as well.
But if there were a core group, who would you say?
Well, I haven't memorized all those names. And, you know.
Was there a core group who would have participated in most of them, who would have sort of been key to the process?
Yes.
And who would those people have been?
You know, there was... the name I remember was Jonathan Eagle on the Goldman side. Somebody called Neil Wright.
Was there anyone else that you remember?
There were quite a lot of people. And I, you know, typically we didn't have the entire list of people who listened on their end. Because, you know, those were conference calls. They were not face-to-face meetings.
Sure.
It was good. Yeah. You know, Jeff Williams also is a name.
Okay.
But this is a short selection, you know. I don't know. I would have to discuss with Dorothy what we can do to give an accurate list.
Okay, great. Great. We can discuss that afterwards. Do you remember and who would have been on the line for Merrill Lynch?
No.
Okay. So, could you tell me a little bit about the process that the company used in responding to the collateral calls after you became involved?
So the process with respect to the collateral call, in what sense?
Well, this is sort of apropos of whether there was a valuation model that you used to respond to their... They gave you values, as I understand it. What now?
So specifically with respect to the valuation model.
Yes.
Right. We had a series of meetings to discuss whether specifically the Goldman collateral call, but also kind of the overall market conditions, were such that we had reached a point where we needed to implement a model to value those transactions and not accept the transaction price anymore. And there was an agreement that we needed to do that.
Who was in that group that agreed to that?
Sorry?
Who was in that group that made that agreement or that came to that conclusion?
That was a shorter group. That was Joe Cassano, Andy Foster, James Bridgewater, somebody called Peter Robinson, and myself.
Okay. I apologize for interrupting.
No, it's okay. And, you know, we agreed that we needed to implement a model, and the process started from that. I mean, it's a fairly lengthy process, so, you know, I think it's better if you maybe ask me specific questions about what you're interested in.
Okay. When did that process start?
That process started... you know, very late August, probably early September. You know, I don't have exact dates.
And what model did you who proposed this in the first instance that you needed the model?
Well, you know, the way it happens is Joe asked every single person at one meeting to kind of think about it, and then we reconvened. And everybody kind of spoke up about whether, you know, he had concluded that we need a model. I think the first couple of meetings were kind of like that.
And then when you came back, did you say
then,
at that point?
Everybody agreed, if you want, on the second meeting that we needed to implement a model.
Okay, so...
Everybody said, you know, I think we should do this and that and that and implement this model. Joe asked a question to the group, asked everybody to think about it, and then on the subsequent meeting or something like that, the, you know, each person spoke and, you know, there was an agreement that we needed to implement them all.
So when you came back to this second meeting, you said, yes, I think that we should implement a model.
Yeah.
And it's my understanding that the company ended up using something called the binomial expansion technique, or BET model, to value its super senior CDS book. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And who proposed the BET model?
I believe the very first person who mentioned the BET model was Peter Robinson.
And were you on board with that suggestion?
Yes. You know, we had various discussions. We talked about the pros and the cons. And... you know, I agreed with the rest of the team that that was the logical path for us to take.
And just so I'm clear, before FP used the BET model, it did not have another model that it used to value these positions. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, these particular positions, the super senior trades on subprime, that's correct. There was no other model, to my knowledge.
Okay.
Valuation model.
Yes, that's exactly. As opposed to the Gorton model, which is an actuarial model.
Yeah. An actuarial risk model.
Okay, so what were the pros and the cons, just briefly? I mean, I don't need a whole lot of detail, but if you could give me some sense of the pros and the cons to the BET model.
So let me remember. One was that it was a widely known, widely known model. Sorry, I'm not speaking properly. So, widely known, although, Peter made it clear that it was mainly used for ratings purposes instead of valuation purposes, but we all agreed that that approach could be used to value transactions. So that was kind of one positive for the BET model. Another one was that we knew that MBIA was using it. The inputs that we would have to feed to the model were, or we felt that they were transparent enough to give us a good enough chance to put everything together and get a valuation that would mean something at the end of the process. So those were the kind of considerations we had.
And the input.
If I may, I apologize. Can I put you on hold for just 10 seconds, please?
Sure.
Sorry.
Pierre is much more of a gentleman than any of the mill bankers are. I don't mind saying that on tape.
We're happy
sorry,
to
I'm
quote back. You. I'm sorry, Mr. Mikortis, have you rejoined us?
Yes.
Thank you. I was just starting to ask you, I believe, about the inputs to the model. It's my understanding that you had some involvement in the use of inputs to the model. If you could describe your involvement in that part of the modeling and valuation process, I would appreciate it, please.
Sure. Well, there were various inputs that we needed to come up with to use the model. I'll go through them quickly. Obviously, there's going to be various deal-specific inputs. Kind of obvious. You need to feed that in the model. We also would need to feed either credit spread or prices in the model for each of the underlying securities that the CDO had invested in. I don't know how familiar you are with these transactions and the underlying, but we had written trade protection on a CDO, and on the super senior tranche of a CDO, the CDO itself had invested into a series of underlying securities, and we needed credit spreads or prices for those underlying securities. We also needed things like weighted average lives for those securities. And recovery rates. Finally, we needed what's called the diversity score. That's one of the inputs that the BET model needs. This is the set of inputs that that we would need to run the model. And for each set of inputs, we had a discussion about how we, where we could find the information. Could we use is there information from different sources, different types of information, and we try to identify what we could do to come up with those inputs, all those inputs. And I participated in these discussions.
And specifically with respect to getting the credit spreads or the prices for the underlying securities in the CDO, as I understand it, the company at first relied on generic JP Morgan data for that, and then later on actually got security-specific pricing information, is that correct?
Yes, the first iteration, which didn't last very long, was for the traders to provide matrices of credit spread for all the securities. I mean, that was an attempt, but it was very brief because the traders concluded that they were just unable to get information. But there was an attempt, maybe just one. Somebody noticed that MBIA had disclosed that they were using credit spread matrices from JP Morgan. I don't recall who spotted that, but that's the reason why we went down that route, found those spreads, and started using them. So we used them for a while, and then the next iteration was to call the managers of all the CDOs, because we had been made aware that some of them were collecting prices for all these underlying securities. And that's kind of the third iteration, certainly as of July last year, that's still the process that AIG, FP, and AIG were using.
Okay, and just so I'm clear, the model that the company used to value its book for purposes of the third quarter 10Q for 2007 used the JP Morgan inputs. But then the 10K for the year 2007 used the CDO manager inputs.
For your end?
Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And so that was on the public disclosure and reporting side. Then on the collateral call dispute side, I mean, it's my understanding that these valuations are useful for two separate reasons. One are public disclosures and filings and working with PwC, FP's accountants, and the other, related but different, is the response and the interaction with FP's counterparties in the valuations on the underlying securities that were relevant to the collateral call disputes. Is that a fair description?
Yes, that's a fair description.
And so I'm trying to determine at what point the valuation process evolved to the point that it allowed FP to use it in responding to counterparties on the collateral calls.
One point to make here is that all our transactions were credit default swap transactions or instruments that are very similar, whereas the pretty much all the collateral provisions were based on formulas which themselves were based on the value of the underlying CDO as a bond. Although there's a correlation, positive correlation between the value of the bond and the value of the credit derivative, you cannot just say that the value of the CDS, of the credit default swap, is, say, par minus the price of the bond. Okay, there is a spread between the two that most market participants call the negative basis.
Right.
One thing we had to do was to worry about the valuation of the trades and also have our own view of the value of the underlying bond.
And the value of the trades was more directly relevant to the public disclosures and the unrealized mark-to-market losses that FP reported publicly and the value of the... No, I think I got that backwards. Sorry.
I was going to say I agree, actually.
Okay, so the collateral provisions are based on the value of the underlying bonds, but for purposes of your public disclosures, you had to value the derivative transaction, and there's a spread between the two.
What was happening with the collateral calls also became a matter of public disclosure.
Right.
All the time.
Right. So did you use the same model in response?
No, you know, we try to address both issues, both the valuations of the trades as well as dealing with the collateral calls.
With the same model?
With the same model.
Okay. And at what point were you able to use the model to respond to Goldman, for example, specifically and say, based on our model, we think that the number is this? Because as I understand it, in July of 2007, the company didn't have a model to value its positions. And so presumably at that point in time, it may have disagreed with Goldman's numbers, but it didn't have its own process to provide sort of an answer to Goldman's collateral call on a specific, using a specific number. So my question is, at what point did FP have a model that it could use to actually give Goldman its own number, and did it in fact do that at any point?
You know, there were quite a few iterations of the model, and even though in its first implementation it didn't it didn't value separately a CDS and a bond, it still gave a reference point that you could use for collateral call discussion. But you know, the first iteration that FP used was and it's not a process that I was personally involved in. You know, I didn't participate to any discussion with Goldman Sachs, but it was more of a kind of a negotiation of what FP was willing to put as collateral and what Goldman Sachs was willing to accept as collateral. And correct, you know, FP at that point didn't have a model, you know, its own model for transactions or the bonds, but it used the whatever reference points the traders found to come up with a view.
Well, Pierre, can you hear me?
Hello?
Pierre, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, Pierre, when you wrote the letter or helped draft the letter that was sent to Goldman on November 29th asking for some money back, did that have anything to do with the output of the BET model, or was that something different?
So the memo at the end of November, we were using valuations based on the prices we had collected from the CDO managers, and we were also using kind of a simple intermediary model to come up with those the bond prices.
Using a simple what model?
Just a simple model where we calculated the asset, the value of all the assets of the CDO, and kind of use a simple approach to see, you know, if the CDO were to be liquidated today, how much of that value would be, you know, would cover the super senior tranche.
Okay, so you didn't use the BET model for that purpose.
Not for the letter you're referring to, though.
And at some point in December or January or February, did you use the BET model in terms of figuring out a number to negotiate with Goldman for?
You know, it was used, the model's output were used as a reference, but, you know, the Goldman and AIG had different views about where the valuations were. Goldman was always... you know, Goldman prices were, you know, up to the last day I spent at AIG FP, were lower than everyone else's, even, you know, in about, you know, even last year. So, you know, it was always a negotiation based on kind of model reference points. But AIG always used what it knew were the model output as a reference.
Mr. Mikatis, what is your understanding as to how AIG came to its decision to post the initial $450 million? And I think it was August 10th.
You know, again, I was not part of the discussions, and the decision was made without my personal involvement. I think it was the result of a negotiation of what FP and AIG were willing to post as collateral and what Goldman Sachs was willing to accept. You know, at that point of time, and certainly for a while afterwards, the markets were very opaque, very liquid, and it just was very hard to know what any of those securities, whether it's the underlying securities of the CDO or the CDO tranches themselves, were worth.
And did you have any understanding that the letter that, and I didn't appreciate you were part of that process, so this is helpful. The letter that asking for the return of some $1.5 billion in November 29th, I think was only a week after AIG posted the additional collateral. So can you walk us through that process, how they did post $2 billion and then a week later requested three-quarters of it back?
I don't remember the timing of the postings. I don't remember, if what you say is true, I didn't remember that that amount was posted shortly before the letter was sent. So I can't really answer the question.
Do you have any insights as to how the $2 billion was posted? I mean, it sounds like you have some insights as to the asking for its return.
Yes, I was involved in that because Joe Cassano asked me, after we had kind of internally agreed on a methodology we could use, to value the collateral exposures, he asked me to work with the one of the legal people to draft the letter and kind of give the numbers to the legal person and the total collateral amount that needed to be returned. But, before that, so that was kind of an active involvement to help the lawyer, but before that, I was made aware of where we stood, but I was not part of the negotiations or strategy.
And the detailed memo, I say it's detailed only because it's long, not because I understand it, of December 20th, 2007, that you wrote articulating observations about the dispute with Goldman, is the methodology discussed in that memo the one that was used to ask for the collateral to come back? And I'm going to get this wrong, but basically not taking into account leakage as Goldman did and perhaps taking the marks up 10%?
Yeah, there's certain information about that in the memo. That model, by some people, was called the collateral model, and not collateral because of collateral call, collateral because it's the collateral of the CDO itself, so valuing the asset side of the CDO. But yes, there's various topics that I've discussed in this memo, including the idea that we could value the super senior tranche by assuming that the whole CDO would be liquidated.
And is this the valuation that was utilized in asking for the return of the $1.5 billion in November 29th?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Okay. And that's different than the BET model?
That was different from the BET model.
Thanks. And how long was... What happened after that, in a sense? I guess Goldman didn't agree with you because they didn't return the collateral, but so how did things progress vis-a-vis the collateral calls as opposed to the valuation for other purposes from November 29th when you asked them to return collateral?
Right. Well, everything moved very quickly, whether it's the market, whether it's what people were saying or thinking. Andy Foster, who had more regular discussions with the Goldman people, told me, kind of kept us updated of what Goldman's thinking was with respect to the right approach, and that was not static. They changed their views as well. I mean, clearly, this collateral model or liquidation model, when we discussed that with them, they kind of had moved on, and they clearly never said they would agree to base the collateral calls on that kind of formulation. I mean, certainly the attempt was to use something that was deemed to be fair and to avoid all the cushions that Goldman was kind of using in their own approach, which all went in their favor, and also kind of just stop talking about either cash flow model or BT model or whatever, just use an approach that would try to come up with a price for all the securities in the CDOs and assume liquidation, ignore leakage and all that, just to have a simple way to do all this stuff. But, you know, that didn't go very far. I mean, they certainly disagreed to use that kind of approach.
So at some point, and it sort of looked to me like there was a bit of a standstill from November 29th until March, and then AIG started posting collateral again in high dollar values to Goldman. So we went, you know, we sort of stayed at $2 billion for a long time. They didn't return at your request, but then there was a point in March when AIG started posting additional large sums. Can you shed any light on why that happened?
So, you know, again, I was not part of, you know, I was not part of the team that was doing all the negotiation with Goldman Sachs. So I can't really tell you what happened. But, you know, obviously one factor in that timeline was the fact that other counterparties had asked for collateral. I mean, that certainly put more weight on the Goldman side of the balance.
While you weren't involved with conversations with Goldman, were you involved in internal conversations with AIG as to whether or not it was appropriate for AIG to post more collateral to Goldman?
I have been for sure involved in meetings, you know, or conference calls where that kind of topic was addressed. But you know, I was generally more of a, you know, kind of listening, ready to answer questions on model valuations or, you know, inputs or stuff like that, rather than kind of lead the conversation about collateral calls. I mean, the collateral call discussion on the FP side was Joe and Andy, mostly Joe, quite frankly.
Can you shed any light? I think that I know that the contracts themselves called for, if there was a dispute about the valuation, called for a dealer poll, for the parties to go and get five dealers to give prices. And we have some understanding that Joe Cassano favored taking that route. Do you have any knowledge of discussions about seeking a dealer poll versus not?
Yeah. I was part of meetings where that topic was discussed. Yes.
Could you shed any light on why FP ended up not pursuing that or forcing that under the contracts?
You know, as I said earlier, for a long period of time, the market was very opaque and completely illiquid, and that's, you know, over a very long period of time. You know, I think it was clear to Goldman, SP, that, you know, that mechanism, that was the legal mechanism, just couldn't work, because you couldn't get five dealers.
So what was your response to, am I correct that Joe Cassano supported forcing a dealer poll?
Yes, you know, I mean, there were meetings where he had a, you know, I remember him expressing a strong view that's what we should do. But, you know, it was also kind of telling Goldman, you know, who claimed that there was a functioning market and that they were giving us actionable prices, that's the term they use all the time, to kind of say, well, if you're right, then this legal requirement is going to work. So, you know, it's just a way to prove somehow that what they were saying wasn't right. You know, to me, you know, it's kind of one argument you use in a negotiation.
So it wasn't that you actually expected, or that Cassano actually expected a dealer poll to work, but it was more of a negotiating tactic to show that, in fact, there wasn't an operating market for these securities.
Oh, and also, Claire, to the extent that she's asking you to say what Cassano was thinking, you know, just say what you know he was thinking, not what you think he might have been thinking.
Yes,
you
know, thank you for that, Dorothy.
What I was going to answer...
Hold on, Pierre, one second. Let's just, I mean, Dixie used an American term, which is, you know, that Cassano didn't think, or might not have thought, that the dealer poll would work. I'm not exactly sure what would work would be. For example, I mean, he may have wanted to get a number lower than Goldman's. It sounds like to me that almost anything, including throwing darts at the wall, would get you a number lower than
higher.
Goldman's.
Higher.
So Dick, help us higher. Depending upon which story, whatever. A number more less favorable to Goldman. So can you be more clear, Dixie, as to, you know, what the hopes and aspirations are to the extent that Pierre knows them?
I'm not sure what my hopes and aspirations are. What I do want to know, Mr. Mikotis, is what Joe Cassano told you or expressed in meetings at which you were present about what he intended to get out of forcing a dealer pull under the contracts with Goldman.
Okay, but what I can tell you is that one topic of discussion was the fact that Goldman Sachs prices have always been very low, at the beginning or at the end of the period. That was one thing. But also the other thing was that the market was very opaque and illiquid, and it was unclear how that, what would happen if we went to a dealer poll. In particular, what would happen if you didn't have any prices left after you removed the top one and the bottom one, or whatever the provision in the CSA said, or in the collateral provision said.
Pierre, is that...
I think it was a little bit all of the above. Goldman always maintained that there were actionable prices, there were rights on market and all that, but there were plenty of things you could think about to disagree with that.
Okay, so Pierre, is that something that you expressed at these meetings, that the market was opaque and illiquid?
Well, I have expressed in various meetings that I believe, because it was certainly true, that the market was opaque or illiquid.
Okay, and did Joe Cassano ever say anything about how serious he was about wanting the dealer pull?
I believe he was serious. I believe he was serious.
Did you agree that that would have been a good approach? Did you agree with the approach Cassano was taking?
I think it, frankly, I think it was very hard to have a strong view because, the markets were so dysfunctional, quite frankly. I didn't have, and the view changed from one day to the next, I mean, there were certain times where I thought, well, maybe if we go, something will happen and we'll get more prices than we think, and other times I was convinced that would never be the case. It was just very hard to have a strong view, so... that was one tactic. If it had been my decision, I wouldn't have taken it. But I'm not sure that that's kind of important.
If it had been your decision, you would not have taken the dealer poll.
Yeah, because I'm a different kind of person than Joe is.
And absent going the contractual route and forcing a dealer poll, what other options did the company have other than just the negotiations on models that AIG and Goldman couldn't agree to? I mean, and what I want you to do partially is take us into the time period after Joe Cassano left FP, to the extent that this question, the answer to this question falls outside that his tenure at FP. What options did the company have, and what ended up happening?
Well, one option we had, and we have discussed on numerous occasions, is to try to tear the deal down.
To tear the deal down, to rip the CDS contracts up, and
to terminate the deal, yeah.
And would that have just involved buying back the bonds?
Not necessarily. It could have, but we could have also agreed to just terminate the deal, and we would have, FP would have had, and AIG would have had no risk. They would have crystallize the mark-to-market loss, so it would be realized, but it could have been done without buying the bond. But even that topic is not something that I was directly involved in. Certainly I've discussed it internally.
Okay, and go ahead.
So frankly, it was also a bit of a dead end because if there had been very serious discussions about unwinding the deals, every day the price would have gotten worse. That's obvious.
And so what actually, can you give us a high-level overview of what happened at on the collateral calls after Joe Cassano left FP? Sort of in the months leading up to the federal government's bailout in September of 2008?
We're really kind of running over. And
I know, that's why I'm asking for a very high level. I'm trying to get through this, but we're almost done.
Okay, I'm just saying this is like all news to me because Pierre has never discussed this with us, so I'm just wondering if we can take a break from that and get back to this question maybe tomorrow or something.
You know, maybe if you could take just 5 minutes and discuss it. The only reason I say that is because I'm in interviews the rest of the week. And I just, it's going to be really hard to, I'm afraid it's going to be hard to find time to.
Okay, well, Pierre, do you understand, were you involved with the high level, were you involved with the collateral call discussions with Goldman after Joe left?
No, I was not involved with anybody directly. You know, I did not negotiate any collateral calls, you know, but the high level answer would be that after Joe Cassano stepped down, AIG took over the lead on those discussions. In particular, the new CEO of FP, Bill Dooley, became one of the main actors. I'm sure, you know, again, I was not involved in those discussions, so you know, I'm sure that Bill himself talked to Martin Sullivan and others to agree on what could be done. And then after September 2008, on the FP side, I know that Andy Forster and some of his traders were consulted and part of discussions, but I don't think that they were doing the negotiations directly. You know, that was taken over. I was out of FP's hands. And that's kind of how I saw it.
So how did you know what was going on with Forster, et cetera?
Because, you know, I had discussions now and then with Andy, and he would tell me, we would know that we had posted amounts. I mean, I was involved in many meetings where sometimes bits of information were given, but that's certainly not something that I was focusing on or I was directly involved in.
So do you, at the FCIC, have a particular question you want to ask about this period? Because it sounds like he has basically partial secondhand knowledge, but is there any particular thing you want to know?
No, not in particular. And I mean, it's helpful for me to know. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Mikatis, but it sounds like you were relatively heavily involved in developing models and valuations, in not negotiating the amounts of collateral calls, but in some discussions with counterparties about the market and the way to address these issues up until sometime in March of 2008, and then after that you were much less involved, and that it was taken over, that entire process was taken over, to your knowledge, by AIG Corporate and by Bill Dooley, the new CEO of FP. Is that right?
That's not how I would qualify it. I would say that what you said is strictly correct with respect to negotiating the amounts of money that AIG and AIGFP would be willing to post as collateral. But discussions about, you know, the modeling and all that, if they had continued after March, I believe I would have been involved as I had been involved before. But it's just that those conversations did not take place anymore with the counterparties. You know, there were no discussions about, oh, I'm doing this for valuation purposes, and I believe in this, and I believe in that. There was none of that after March, I think.
Okay.
Can I ask two quick, very quick housekeeping questions? You noted that from the end of 07 through 09, well, you basically reported to the CEO of FP. Did you report also to anyone at AIG Inc.?
Yes, and I apologize. I don't remember the exact date, but I had an official solid reporting line to Bob Lewis.
Okay.
At some point.
Perfect.
That's easy to find out that later. I don't have it in mind. Apologies.
Would that be generally while you were acting as Chief Risk Officer of FP?
No, because I was Chief Risk Officer of FP before I had an official reporting line to Bob.
Okay.
Oh, so that came, the official reporting line to Bob came after January of 07, but not at January 07.
Yes, it came quite a long time after that.
Do you know what?
But you know, the thing is, we, you know, even though formally it changes kind of the reporting structure, it didn't really change the way AIG, FP, and AIG work together.
Sure. Is it fair to say that, in 2007 you had no direct reporting line to AIG Inc., you just reported through the CEO of FP?
That was my formal reporting line to Joe, basically.
And if you can give me the 30-second answer, why was it determined that you needed a direct reporting line also to Bob Lewis?
I mean, that was the kind of development of the discussions with PwC, I believe. And it was felt that what had been more of a dotted reporting line up to that point should be more formal.
Okay. And my last housekeeping issue is during that time period, end of January 07 through the following year, did you have any discussions with regulators, the OTC, OTS or FSA or others?
Yes, I met the OTS during that time period, but also before on multiple occasions.
And I
haven't met the FSA that often, but I did meet them.
I'm sorry, I'm going to try to...
also include the Commission Bancaire.
I'm going to try to keep it
on numerous occasions.
Brief by asking if any of those discussions related to the multi-sector CDS portfolio. You wore many hats, I know.
After mid-07, yes.
You did meet with regulators regarding the CDS multi-sector portfolio?
Yeah.
One more clarifying thing. I think it wasn't really clear, but I think if you had asked him, he would have said that he had an open and free, you know, communication with Bob Lewis or Kevin McGinn, but it just wasn't part of the formal structure.
Right. Mr. Mikotis, just a final clarification. Were you the primary point of contact for the OTS?
No.
Who else would have been involved in this? Who would have been the primary point of contact?
Any regulator. There was generally, you know, other people within FP or AIG were the primary contact. But I was brought in either at the request of the regulators or because FP or AIG felt that I was the right person to include in the team that they wanted to put in front of the regulators.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Mikotis, that's all the questions we have for now. Thank you very much for making yourself available. And I can speak on behalf of myself and at least one of my colleagues here that we were very sad that we could not come to London and do this in person. But thank you again. And Dorothy, actually, I have to run because we're getting kicked out of our conference room, but can I call you back in just a couple of minutes to discuss?
Well, actually, it was Andy who wanted to talk to you, and he had to jump off.
So. Oh, okay. Well, just shoot me an email and let me know what time works for this afternoon.
Okay, perfect.
Great. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.